We were in chapter 5. Okay. Now, we talked about the necessity of free will. We said you need free will, number one, so that there could be commands, and number two, so that there could be reward and punishment. Now, I'll just let you know that although that's what the Rambam says, and the Rambam is right, it's controversial. That is to say, it's controversial in secular sources. The Rambam is surely right, and those secular sources against are confused. Now, here we come to a part of the ways. I can tell you about the secular sources and tell you why they're confused, or we can go on. I'm happy to go on.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Okay, like, I command my dog to act certain ways, and I reward my dog also, and my dog doesn't seem to have very much free will, so.
Okay, this is the problem that you find in secular sources. Now, the truth is, this question and the philosophy behind it is based on a trick. And the trick is to change the subject in a subtle way so that these considerations that you raise, and I'll explain them in more detail, are all interesting, important, relevant, and logical to a different subject. And so, if you don't keep the subjects clearly different in your mind, then it can sound like there's an argument here. But once you distinguish the subjects, you see that they're just relevant and interesting and important and logical to a different subject, but not to our subject. I'll explain how the argument goes without telling you the difference between subjects. Maybe it'll sound convincing, you know, important and significant, and then I'll say what the difference in subject is. So we said, you need free will for a command to be relevant. Now he says, so we command dogs, we train them, right? We train them to obey our commands. Dog doesn't have free will, and yet commanding seems to be reasonable, relevant, appropriate, you know, it functions. That's our position, and it's obvious. Okay, we can take that for that. Explaining our position after all. But it is obvious. Furthermore, don't we reward and punish dogs? Don't we reward them when they fulfill our commands? Don't we punish them when they don't fulfill our commands? And all that seems to work. So why would you think that commanding and rewarding and punishing requires free will? Indeed, why do we command? What's the point in commanding anybody, anytime, anywhere? And what's the point in rewarding and punishing anytime, anywhere, to anybody? Isn't it to change the person's behavior? Presumably to improve his behavior? So, if the commanding and the rewarding and punishing can serve its purpose of improving behavior, then it should be fully appropriate and justified. So let's think. Given this purpose of improving behavior, do we need to assume free will so that commanding and rewarding and punishing can achieve that purpose? And the answer is clearly no. All you have to assume is that the commanding and the rewarding and the punishing have an effect. If they have an effect in changing the behavior of the one to whom you issue the command and the one to whom you deliver the reward and the punishment, then commanding and rewarding the punishing can have its effect, its serve its purpose of changing behavior. And that clearly doesn't require free will. All you need to assume is that the machine you're addressing, whether it be a transistor or a magnetized coil machine or a flesh and blood machine, All you have to assume is that the machine is sensitive to commanding, and the machine is sensitive to rewarding and punishing. You don't have to have free will for that. And the dog is a good example. You need to do it with computers. So why would anyone think you need free will to justify commanding and rewarding and punishing? Have you got the question now? You don't get the question. Why don't you get the question? So let me just try to repeat it. Let's go step by step and see.
No, I understand the question.
Oh, you understand the question? Yeah. Okay, I understand the question. Okay. Now, the crucial mistake here, I must tell you, I've heard this objection is very widely used philosophically by, I would call them, second echelon philosophers, like Daniel Dennett and company. And I always felt it was wrong. I always was convinced that it was wrong, but I couldn't say clearly what was wrong with it until I read a paper by a very good contemporary philosopher named Susan Wolf. She explained it clearly, and then I kicked myself because what she said is part of things that I have taught. I just didn't put two and two together and got four. Anyway, here's the difference. What that argument is designed to show is that commanding and rewarding and punishing can serve their purpose even if there's no free will. Let's say we agree to that. Yes, they can serve their purpose. Was that the question we were dealing with? Were we dealing with the question of whether they can serve their purpose? That wasn't our question at all. Our question was, are they valid? The Rambam says that if there's no free will, then rewarding and punishing are invalid. They're unjust. He didn't say anything about serving their purpose. He said they're unjust. He doesn't mention commanding in this respect, but commanding is invalid in a certain philosophical way. We're not talking about value, we're talking about truth. Those are two different subjects. And indeed, many false ideas are valuable. The fact that an idea is valuable doesn't say anything about whether it's true or not. Plato said, in the ideal republic, the ideal city, what you should do is tell people that each person's soul is made of a different kind of metal. And the metal you have in your soul determines what role you will play in the city. If you have a gold soul, then you're going to be the philosopher king. And if you have a brass soul, you're going to be a warrior, and so forth and so on. And Plato says, this is of course not true. Certainly not true. But it's very valuable. Because if each person believes that his soul determines his place in the community, he won't be envious of other people. People will cooperate. They won't be trading positions. So let's tell people this myth so as to get people to cooperate and build a very successful city. The fact that an idea functions well and serves a valuable purpose doesn't say anything about it being true. John Stuart Mill said he should act for the sake of the greatest good, greatest happiness, was asked, or his attitude towards the Ten Commandments. And he said, you know, I could agree that the Ten Commandments are a good idea. Because to teach everybody to act to maximize the sum total happiness of all people affected, for most people that have just caused paralysis. How am I supposed to know the sum total of bad happiness of all people affected? I'll never be able to figure that out, and I'll never be able to make a genuine decision. So he says, I could recommend, don't teach my philosophy to most people, they're not going to grasp it, they're not going to be able to use it. Teach the Ten Commandments. Okay, the Ten Commandments aren't really true, but people will act better with that false idea in their heads than they will if they're trying to deal with my philosophy. So the fact that an idea is useful, valuable, and serves a purpose doesn't get to anything about it being true. Our question is it true? Is it valid philosophically? Is it appropriate? Is it justifiable? Not that does it serve a purpose. So this whole discussion, it's what could be called the pragmatic fallacy. It's pragmatically successful, it has nothing to do with it being true. Now there is a famous American school of philosophy called pragmatism, and I taught it, starting from Charles Sanders Peirce, who was the founder of it, through Jameson, through Dewey, and through Quine. And I know that's pragmatic philosophy, but I just didn't see that that's what's going on in this discussion of free will. So, yes, it could serve its purpose and have a valuable contribution to make to improving people's behavior. That says nothing about its being true. Okay, I hope that will immunize you when you come across this kind of philosophical sleight of hand, you know, sort of switch the subject in the middle.
How is it not true? Like, what do you mean that it's not true? That you can't?
Well, to punish a person when he did not make a free choice is unjust, because he's not responsible for it. It's like when A pushes B down the stairs and B's body smashes something at the bottom, and we all agree it's inappropriate to punish B because he didn't make a free choice. So if there is no free will, then nobody deserves to be punished.
But then it's not just to train your dog? Or
if your dog were not qualitatively inferior to you, then of course it would be unjust. Peter Singer thinks it's unjust even though it's qualitatively inferior to you. We only do it to dogs because they don't deserve justice. I have no requirement to be just to a dog. There's a lot of requirement to be compassionate to a certain extent, not to inflict upon it unnecessary pain. But I imprison it, I take it with me as I please, I determine how its air will be cut. I don't treat it as an equal. I don't owe it any justice at all. Okay. That's what's going on today. Now, in the end of chapter 5, the Rambam raises that famous question of foreknowledge and free will. If God knew yesterday already what I'm going to do today, how could I possibly be making a free choice today to do it? There's a lot of Jewish literature on this subject, but since we're doing Hillel Shir of the Rambam, I'll tell you what he says. It's not exactly simple, but I'll tell you what he says. But first, let me just say abstractly what the problem is. I want you to know that philosophy struggled with formulating the problem for a long time, explicitly for decades and implicitly for hundreds of years, to get a formulation of the problem. It was finally achieved in 1965 by a paper written by a fellow named Nelson Pike, published in Philosophical Review. Since then, his paper is the one that's cited by everybody as explaining what the problem is. And I will read to you, you'll see that 900 years before him, the Rambam has exactly the right formulation of the problem. Of course, you expect Nelson Pike and other secular philosophers to read the Rambam. But the Rambam has it word for word. But anyway, here's the problem. Let's imagine I make a free choice. That means I have two alternatives, at least, let's say two, A and B. Each alternative is possible for me. I could do either one. Then I choose. Then I choose A. So why did I do A? Because I chose A. I could have chosen B, and had I chosen B, I would have done B. But that is, I happen to choose A. That's what we mean by a free choice. Now, yesterday already, God knew that I was going to choose A. Now let's ask, if already yesterday God knew that I was going to choose A, was B really open for me? Was B really possible? Was B really available? Could I really have done B? Let's see. If I did B, then that would contradict God's knowledge yesterday. God's knowledge yesterday is that I'm going to do A. If I end up doing B, that would contradict his knowledge. Now, God's knowledge is perfect. It is infallible. It's not just that God is right and gets it right by accident, so to speak. Like the weatherman, you know. Shall I look at the satellite photos? I know. That's amazing. That's just saying it's going to rain. And then it rains, and he gets it right. God's knowledge isn't right by accident. God's knowledge is infallible. That means it's impossible for God's knowledge to be wrong. Okay. Now, if we say that it's possible for me to do B, then that means it's possible for God's knowledge to be contradicted. Which means it's possible for God not to be wrong. But it ain't. It's not possible for God's knowledge to be wrong. That means we can't say that B was possible. Well, that means B wasn't possible. So I didn't really have two alternatives. I only had one alternative to do A. And since we describe free will as having two possible alternatives, we must be wrong. There can't be free will. That's the right way to say the problem. The right way to say the problem is that God's knowledge yesterday of what I do cuts off the possibility of what I don't do. And therefore I'm left with only one possibility. And that's not free choice. Free choice isn't the choice of one possibility. Free choice has got to be the choice between at least two possibilities. That's the name of the problem. Now this is the way the Rambam puts the problem. I'll read it for you. Well, is any point in reading in Hebrew? I'll translate. Yeah. Those who can read it, this is Perkei Elohei. Perhaps you'll say, doesn't God know everything that will be? And before this person is either a tzaddik or a rasha, righteous or wicked, does he know that he will be righteous or wicked, or doesn't he know? So of course we say he does know. And if he knows, if God knows that he will be righteous, then, says Maimonides, it's impossible that he shouldn't be righteous. Notice, if God knows he will be righteous, then the alternative of not being righteous becomes impossible. And if you will say that God knows he will be righteous and yet it is possible for him to be wicked, where's the contradiction? Why couldn't it be possible for him to be wicked and God knows that he will be righteous? If you say that, then it comes out that God doesn't know what he knows perfectly. Because although he knows it, it's possible that he's wrong. That can't be. Can't be possible that he's wrong. So, since God's knowledge has to be absolute, perfect, there can't even be a possibility that the person is doing other than what God knows he will do. And therefore, the other alternative becomes impossible. Okay, yeah.
If God knows that, just because he knows that someone's going to do something doesn't mean he has control over that.
You're right. He's not exerting control. The beauty of this problem is you can picture God as totally passive. This problem assigns no activity to God at all. Activity is another sort of problem that Rome deals with in a later chapter. But here you're picturing God as totally passive. And that alone, just his passive knowledge, is enough to contradict free will. Now, you, by what you said, you're leaning in a certain direction, which in the end is one of the solutions. But let me, I'm not saying the problem has no solutions, I'm just formulating the problem. Okay? Let me rehearse what I'm saying, and then I'll just show you where I think you're pushing, and as I said, that is one of the solutions. The problem that is formulated is this. The person does something, and then we ask, what does God's knowledge do to his alternatives he didn't do? If you turn away from what he did and look at his alternatives that weren't realized, the alternatives unchosen, past not been. Right? And we say God's knowledge wipes out those unused alternatives. Wipes out the unused alternatives and leaves him with only the one he did, and that's not a choice. Your slant is to say, why are you focusing on the unused alternatives? Why don't you focus on what he did? Now, God's knowledge didn't push him or force him to do what he did, so why is he still free? That's one of the solutions. Okay? But you understand that you'll have to reform, you have to change your picture of what a free decision is. Right? We think a free decision between two alternatives. Take away one alternative, leave only one. That isn't our model of the way free decisions are made. So to move in this direction, you have to change the model of the way free decisions are made. And indeed, there are people who do that. Right? But I'm interested in actually formulating the problem in an accurate way. Okay, now let's see how the Rambam answers it. I'll read you his words, translate, and then we'll have to formulate it in a way that we can understand. Rama says you should know that the answer to this question is longer than the earth and wider than the sea, and a number of fundamental principles, big, important fundamental principles, and great mountains are hanging on it. But you need to know and understand what I will say. In other words, I'm not giving you the full background, I'm not giving you the full justification, I'm not giving you all the extra material, but I'll tell you enough to answer it immediately. We already explained, he said, above, in the Laws of Fundamentals of the Torah, chapter 2, that God doesn't know through a knowledge outside himself, like people do. Rather, he and his knowledge, I'm sorry, the people are he and they and their knowledge are two. Rather, he and his knowledge are one. I'll explain this. A person and his knowledge are two things. The proof of it is that the person exists before he gets the knowledge, and then he gets the knowledge. Sometimes he forgets, loses the knowledge, and he remains the same person. So clearly, the person and the knowledge are two different things. Right? The person can stay the same, and the knowledge can change. So they aren't identical. God isn't like that. God and his knowledge are one thing. And it is not possible for the mind, the understanding of a person, to understand this thing. Just like a man cannot understand God's essence, so it is impossible for a person to understand the knowledge of the Creator. That being the case, we don't have the ability to understand how God knows what he knows. And therefore, we are free to say that man has free will without worrying about contradiction.
Explain it one more time.
I didn't explain it at all. I just translated it. I said it. I translated it, and I'll explain it. I didn't explain it at all. I believe, is what the Rambam means. Let's start with his foundation. We can't know anything about God's essence. We can't describe God's essence. God's essence is beyond all description and all understanding. In the guide, the Rambam says we can't even say about God that he exists. Can't even say he exists. The idea behind this, and another example, a fellow named Gilbert Ryle, a noted philosopher in the middle of the 20th century, cooked up a logical idea. He had no idea that Maimonides beat him by 900 years. Because why should they beat Maimonides? I'll tell you what Ryle said, and I'll show you Maimonides had the same idea. We use words to describe things. Words and the concept behind them, to describe things. Each description belongs in a certain category. It's designed to apply within a certain category. Within that category, it makes sense. It might be correct or incorrect, but it makes sense. Take it outside the category, and it makes no sense. Here are some examples. Let's take yellow. Weighs 5 pounds. Is square. Is in North Dakota. Those terms are designed to describe physical objects. That's where their application lies. That's what they're for, to describe physical objects. Now, if I say this table is brown, it's true. If I say the table is blue, it's in the right category, it just doesn't happen to be true. Now, take those terms and push them into a different category and watch. You'll get nothing but nonsense. What color is the number 6? How much does it weigh? What shape does it have? Where is it located? What is its density? Is it flammable or inflammable? Is it flexible or brittle, the number six? I hope you get the idea. These are idle questions. The number six? The number six doesn't have a color, it doesn't have a shape, it doesn't have a weight, it doesn't have a brittleness index. Those terms aren't designed to describe numbers. They're designed to describe physical objects. Take it outside the physical object category, what you get is nonsense. It doesn't have to be numbers. Your idea of love. How much does it weigh? What shape is it? What color is it? What size is it? What density does it have? Is it brittle or is it flexible? Give me a break. Your idea of love doesn't have any of those qualities. It's just not designed to have those qualities. And vice versa, numbers are even or odd. Numbers are prime or composite. So is the table even or odd? Prime or composite? It's the wrong question. It doesn't have any of those things. Take a descriptive term outside its category, and it's nonsense. Now, let's reflect. God is outside all of the categories of our descriptions. God isn't a physical object, so all the physical object words don't apply. God isn't a number, so all the numerical words don't apply. God isn't a concept, so all the conceptual words don't apply. God isn't a property, so all the property words don't apply. God is outside all of our categories of description, so all of our words of description don't apply to it. It's like oil and water, you know, they just don't mix. So that's
knowledge
why
also that doesn't apply to humor, right?
I'm sorry, say
knowledge.
Right. So now, let's just do a little quiz so we understand. So therefore, knowledge doesn't apply to him.
And time,
all these things. So now let's say, if knowledge doesn't apply to him, does that mean he's ignorant? Can't be ignorant either, because ignorant is another term. It's another term for categories that we use. You can't say he knows, and you can't say he's ignorant. You can't say anything. And my mind is an example of this. Is the father. He says, consider a stone wall. Could you say that that stone wall is bald? But surely it's not hairy either. It's not hairy and it's not bald. Because hairy and bald are terms for mammals that grow hair. Some mammals that grow hair have their hair and they're hairy. And some mammals that grow hair don't have their hair and they're bald. But stones aren't hairy and stones aren't bald. It's just the wrong words to use. That's his example. And in the same sense, he says, none of our terms apply to God. Because he's outside the categories of description. So nothing we say about God is correct. If we're trying to talk about God, it's always a failure. It's always a failure. We never get there. Because the words are used outside the category that they're supposed to describe. And even exists, Maimonides says in the guide. This is part of the background which he hints to here, just certain very great principles are dependent upon this. He doesn't tell you this over here in the Mishnah Torah. I know it for the guide, that's why I'm telling you. Okay?
For all the failures, why are we allowed to even begin to start, you know, using the hand of God, even though it's a...
Okay, so the natural question is, if all of these are failures, what are we going to do with the hundreds and hundreds of descriptions that our literature is full of? The Tanakh, the Talmud, the Midrash, the Siddur, is full of hundreds of descriptions of God. What is all that stuff if you can't describe God? And the answer that Maimonides gives, and I want you to know that the Kabbalistic tradition gives exactly the same answer. The answer is, we don't describe what God is, describe what God does. God reveals himself to us in various ways. There are certain effects in the world from him, and we can describe those effects. We can describe those effects, but we don't have a clue as to what is causing those effects. Have a clue. As an analogy, think of light. Everyone lives with light. We We see it all the time. We don't know how to create it. Make fires. 1,000 years ago, did they have a clue what light was? Not a clue. They tell people it's made up of little particles, so small you can't see them one by one. What would they do with that? You say it's made of waves, because the particles wave, even without quantum mechanics. Because each particle has a certain wavelength. How can a particle have a wavelength? And with quantum mechanics, the particles aren't there until you look. And when you look, they suddenly pop into existence. And when you close your eyes, they are replaced by the square root of a complex number which represents their probability. So it's a complex number which is the square root of the probability. Superposed on other possible complex square roots of probability in a kind of superposed fuzz of square roots. Until you look, when all the fuzz disappears, and then all of a sudden the photon pops into existence. Now, for the 20th century, no one had a clue that that was right. But they could tell you a lot about light. They could tell you that sunlight has in it all the different hues, and they could tell you that sunlight also produces heat, and they could tell you you can reflect it with mirrors. There's a lot they could tell you about how it behaves. They just didn't have a clue as to what it is. Now, in a somewhat similar way, we're being told that God manifests himself in a variety of ways in the world, but the reality behind the manifestations is something that we have no knowledge of whatsoever. So, here's the rule. When you have what looks like a description of God, what you have to do is translate it into a description of action. Instead of a description of what he is, it has to be translated into a description of action. What happens? How do you work the translation? And by the way, for those in the know, I'm taking a general idea here from a certain movement, philosophy of science, which is wrong, but it was a famous thing called fictionalism. How do you work the translation? You do it like this. The description in our literature says God is X. Pretend for a minute it's literally true. Pretend that God really is X. Now ask yourself, if God really is X, what would he do? What kind of action would being X lead to? Oh, okay, so if he was really X, he would do A, he would do B, he would do C. Someone who's X really does A, B, and C. Good. Now, subtract X and just retain A, B, and C. Because it isn't the truth that he's X. You can't describe what he is altogether. But now you have your translation. Instead of saying that he is X, you say that what happened is A, B, C. And then you're talking about him at all. You're talking about what happened. So, for example, you say God is just. God is just. Well, what would God do if he were just, playing along with it fictitiously for the moment? Well, he would certainly reward people who are righteous and deserving, and he would punish people who are wicked, and the reward would be commensurate with the righteous actions, and the punishment only goes to people who really deserve it. That's what he would do if he were really just. Okay, now just subtract justice and say the righteous will get their reward, and the reward will be commensurate with what they did, and the wicked will be punished, and they'll only be punished if they really deserve it. That's all. Let's leave the justice out. God loves the Jewish people. Okay, suppose he did. What would that mean in practice? Well, that they would be favored in various ways. They would get special treatment, and special consideration, and special reward. Okay, now just subtract the law and say the Jewish people will be supported in certain ways in practice and will be rewarded in certain ways, and so on and so on. That's the method. When you see X, the scripture says God is X, ask yourself, well, if he's X, what would he do? And then subtract the X and just retain the description of what would happen. Now, that's pretty easy for justice and for loving Jewish people. It's a little more challenging for knowledge, but it can be done there as well. I want you to know that the Kabbalist, Moshe Chaim Lutzato in particular, says explicitly, word for word, that God's knowledge is a description of his action, along with other characteristics. He includes it twice on one page. So let's see, how do we do it? Well, if God was omnipotent, omniscient, knew everything, what effect would that have in actions? I believe, this is my way of doing it, I believe it means that everything that happens will be appropriately coordinated with everything else that happens. After all, what would someone do with knowledge? How would someone's knowledge affect his action? When he acts, he would take into account everything else and make sure that what he does now is appropriate for everything else. So say that God knows everything will mean that the things that happen in the world are perfectly coordinated with everything else that happens in the world. It forms a perfect system. Okay, so now just subtract the knowledge. And what you end up with is things that happen in the world are perfectly coordinated. So at this point, we are not saying that God knows. And we're also not saying he's ignorant. We're just not saying. We're doing something very un-Jewish. We're learning to keep quiet. When it comes to God, we're not going to talk about it at all. Okay, now back to the problem. I haven't finished explaining the wrong book. There's extroverted here, and I'll get to that in a second. But anyway, what was our problem? Our problem was a contradiction between A and B. Well, if there's a contradiction between A and B, and you decide to give up A, they didn't have a contradiction anymore. Contradiction is a conflict between A and B. If you give up A, then there's no conflict. Contradiction was between God's knowledge on the one hand and our free will on the other hand. If you give up God's knowledge, then there's no contradiction. Now, this means I'm treating God's knowledge, so to speak, the same way as we treat his essence. Now, none of these made that explicit comparison. So just like we don't understand his essence, so we don't understand his knowledge either. The leftover question, which bothered me for a long time, is if we don't understand it, if we can't do anything about it, why call it knowledge at all? Why did he say we can't know how he knows? More thorough and exact way to put it, I think, would have been to say, we don't say he knows at all. Not, we don't know how he knows, or we can't understand his knowledge, but yet call it knowledge. My oldest son, I have learned a great many things. My oldest son suggested that the best way to read the Rambam here is this. It's true that he doesn't have knowledge. He doesn't know. But he has all the capabilities that knowledge would have given him. When we say that he doesn't have knowledge, we shouldn't be taken to impute to attribute to him any weakness, any incapacity. So when he says he knows, we don't know how he knows, what he means is he can do everything and nowhere can do it. If I just tell you he doesn't know, he might make the mistake of thinking he's ignorant, they lack knowledge, they're sitting up there, you know, blind. So I might want you to understand that all the capacities and abilities that we understand that he knows or has, he has. But it doesn't happen by what we call knowledge. It's not what we call knowledge. It's via something else which we can't imagine. Okay? Yeah.
You said before that he said he had knowledge. Said everything that knowledge does, will he still think you say that? And he had that for his money.
But that's what happens. That's
right. And if we're a person who had knowledge, we make everything work out. If a person who had knowledge and created the world, would also, right, also make everybody do certain things that's working out.
Depends upon what he wants in creating the world. Maybe he wants them to act on their own. But he wouldn't make them do this. That depends on what he wants. That has nothing to do with knowledge. That has to do with his plan.
Not knowing what we're going to do, instead of a lack of knowledge, even though he doesn't have knowledge,
what happens.
It is incorrect to say he doesn't know what they're going to do. That's incorrect. It's just incorrect to say he doesn't know what they're going to do. The word, he doesn't know what they're going to do, is a positive description of it. That's why I said you can't say he's ignorant. What you're now saying is that he's ignorant. That's incorrect. Two mistakes here. First of all, as a general remark, the fact that God doesn't do something says nothing about whether he has control. Control is a potentiality. I can have control and decide not to exercise. That doesn't mean I don't have control. Okay? But more to the point in this particular question, we're not now doing a total theology of God. We're talking about one aspect, namely knowledge. Right? If I choose to talk about knowledge, it doesn't mean I'm saying he doesn't do other things. I'm not talking about that now. I'm talking about the problem of knowledge. There is another problem of activity. I'll have to consider that in a later chapter. The question here is only whether there's a contradiction between God's knowledge and our actions. And this very fundamental, radical way of handling it does eliminate the problem. We don't say that he knows. Yeah.
I was wondering if it's right to say that his will affects the outcome enough that just like after the point of his will of the outcome, that would affect it enough for him to know. I don't know if that's the way I would put it. Just that his will affects the outcome, and by his will being the his will for the outcome being the root of the action, then that will would be the source of his knowledge of what's going to happen.
What I've been describing in the last 15 minutes is that we don't say he has knowledge obvious.
Yeah.
So I can't get to your conclusion because my vocabulary is ruled out. It's just words that I can't say.
But not knowledge, like more like he that the fact that he's aware of what's going to happen, or
you don't talk like that anymore.
Okay,
you're doing God's biography, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't do that. God's essence is beyond all description whatsoever. But when you say he's aware, then it comes out to mean everything that happens takes everything else into account. That's all. Doesn't mean that he's aware. I'm not talking about his life. Is he awake? Is he sleeping? You know? Does he have telescopes? That's not the subject. The subject is, how are the things that happen in the world described? What qualities do they have? He's all powerful. I'm not talking about his bulging muscles. I'm not talking about his access to atomic generators. And he's all powerful. What it means is, there's no limit on what can happen. There's no way to set a limit and say this part can happen and then another thing can't happen. This is a limit, but that's a statement about what can happen, not a statement about him.
Yes. Everything comes from God. That word and everything else comes from you. He has to have that. If he creates that, the person has to have the word. If he creates the person, creates something that has words in it and has knowledge and has everything else, and the person created it has to have that.
You don't mean that.
I make a watch. I come like a watch.
Just be serious.
He doesn't know that he made a watch.
You shift the ground. What you said a moment ago was that if he made it, then he has to have it. Right? And that's
right.
Silly.
Right.
It's like a lot of this armchair philosophy, which is just silly. Stop and think of kind of examples.
Yes.
Now, if you're a psychologist and you have discovered a certain psychological syndrome and you give it a definition, autism, schizophrenia, right, you define it. Does that mean you have to be schizophrenic?
No.
Well, that's because you are a human being who operates with knowledge. Yes, because for you, the alternative would be to be ignorant. And you couldn't do it if you're ignorant. But we're talking about a guy who's neither knowledgeable nor ignorant. He does it in a different way altogether.
He still created that.
Yes, he did. But when he creates it, you cannot infer that he must have it or even know about it. You're inferring it from your experience of human beings. A phosphorescent stone. A phosphorescent stone creates life. Must it know about life? No, because stones create life without knowledge. They're a different kind of thing. When they create, knowledge isn't involved. Some things use knowledge to create, and some things don't use knowledge to create. Right? You're just generalizing for human beings. I mean, but this is easy. What happens here, I'll just tell you, in philosophy, you get lost in an abstract proposition, and you think, gosh, that sounds right. The easy way to test it is ask for simple, everyday examples of how it's supposed to apply. Half the time you discover the principle's wrong, and the other half the time you discover that you can't apply it, so you don't know what it means. Right? And you find out that all this Pavlov philosophy is just shooting the breeze, you know, it's good after the third beer, but it's not that to be taken seriously. And there can't be any more of the effect of the cause or this kind of stuff. It just doesn't wash. Yeah. Yeah, but then it would only be an illusion. And,
Yeah,
it's an illusion. You know, I don't know if you've seen these examples, but when they hypnotize somebody, they tell them, you hypnotize and say, when you wake, you won't remember this, but in 5 minutes, you're going to get down on the floor and crawl. It wakes them up, you know, they're chatting. You know, 5 minutes later, he suddenly gets off the chair and he starts crawling on the floor. So the guy says to him, why are you crawling on the floor? And he says, I lost the quarter, and I'm looking for the quarter. Right? So after a couple of minutes, he says, did you find the quarter yet? Yeah, well, actually, I lost a pin, and it's very hard to find the pin, so I'm looking for the pin. I know what's going on here. He thinks he's decided to crawl on the floor. And part of it realized that this is crazy, so he makes up reasons why he is under no, he has no idea that he's really a robot. But he's really a robot. Well, we don't want to accept that. We don't be robots like that.